You're listening to WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. As the show gets up and running on WBTV, I'm airing a number of past interviews. As of next week, I'll again be sharing some new interviews, one a week, as well as one past interview a week. Today you're going to hear a conversation from 2012 with former Vermont Governor Madeline M. Cunin. When Madeline M. Cunin became the 77th governor of the state of Vermont, she became the first woman to serve in that role and the first Jewish woman to be elected governor of any U.S. state. She served as the Deputy Secretary of Education and Ambassador to Switzerland under President Bill Clinton. She's the author of Living a Political Life, Pearls, Politics, and Power, and the New Feminist Agenda. She's a Marsh Scholar, Professor at Large at the University of Vermont, and lectures on history and women's studies. She also serves on the board of the Institute for Sustainable Communities, a non-governmental organization that she founded in 1991. She lives in Burlington, Vermont. When I spoke to Governor Cunin, she had just published the New Feminist Agenda, defining the next revolution for women, work, and family. Here's a description of that book, which was published in 2012. So I just ask that you keep in mind that some of these statistics may have changed, but probably not very much yet. Feminists opened up thousands of doors in the 60s and 70s, but decades later, are U.S. women where they thought they would be? The answer, it turns out, is a resounding no. Surely there have been gains. Women now comprise nearly 60% of college undergraduates and half of all medical and law students. They have entered the workforce in record numbers, making the two-wage earner family the norm. But combining a career and family turned out to be more complicated than expected. When women changed, social structures surrounding work and family remained static. Affordable and high-quality childcare, paid family leave, and equal pay for equal work remain elusive for the vast majority of working women. In fact, the nation has fallen far behind other parts of the world on the gender equity front. We lag behind more than 70 countries when it comes to the percentage of women holding elected federal offices. Only 17% of corporate boards include women members, and just 5% of Fortune 500 companies are led by women. It's time, says Madeline Cunin, to change all that. Looking back over five decades of advocacy, she analyzes where progress stalled, looks at the successes of other countries, and charts the course for the next feminist revolution, one that mobilizes women and men to call for the kind of government and workplace policies that can improve the lives of women and strengthen their families. When I spoke with Governor Cunin in 2012, I asked that she begin by reading from the New Feminist Agenda. The excerpt that follows is the opening of the book. I hope you enjoy this conversation with our former governor.
Time for a new revolution. Five of us were meeting for lunch and reminiscing about the women's movement. I was never one of those angry women, one said. I'm still angry, I blurted. My reaction surprised both me and my friends. Where did that come from? A source I hadn't tapped before. Upon reflection, I realized that I'm not angry enough to carry a placard down hot macadam streets in front of the nation's capital like I did in my 30s when I marched for women's rights. But now in my 70s, I'm still dissatisfied with the status quo and harbor a passion for change. Old age allows me the luxury of being impatient. There's not so much time left, and it permits me to say what I think, to be demanding, and best of all, to imagine a different world where there is true gender equality in the workplace, the home, and the political arena. Why the anger? What did I expect? I expected that the women's movement of the 1970s would give me a good answer to the questions my students regularly asked. How do you manage to have a family and a career? I expected that affordable quality childcare would be widely available, that paid family leave would be the law, and that equal pay for equal work would be a reality. I did not expect that women would still make 77 cents for every dollar that men earn. I expected that one-third to one-half of our Congress, governors, state legislatures, and mayors would be female. I did not expect that in 2010 that number would be 17% in the Congress and the United States would be tied at 69th place in the percentage of women in parliaments out of 178 countries. I expected that one-third to one-half of corporate board members would be women. I did not expect to see that proportion also stuck at 17%. I expected that a high percentage of the Fortune 500 companies would be led by women. I did not expect that figure to be 3%. I expected that misogyny, rape, and other acts of violence against women would be widely condemned and sharply reduced. I did not expect that a female journalist could be sexually abused in the middle of Cairo's Tahrir Square and then blamed for bringing it on herself, as Laura Logan of CBS News experienced in February 2011. I expected that Roe v. Wade would remain the law of the land. I did not expect that it would be eroded state by state. Some changes occurred that I had not expected and could not have imagined. That women would comprise nearly 60% of college undergraduates. That women would comprise half of the medical and law students. That women would enter the workforce in record numbers. And that the traditional family supported by the father would be overtaken by the two-wage earner or single-wage earner family. That's the good news. The bad news is that many women who have careers that we never could have imagined for ourselves are still flummoxed by the most age-old problem, how to have a job and take care of the children, the elderly, the sick, and the disabled.
That's Governor Madeleine M. Cunin reading from The New Feminist Agenda, Defining the Next Revolution for Women, Work, and Family, and that's published by Chelsea Green. Thank you very much for reading that. So I wonder, ideally, who would you like to see reading this book, and what is your goal for what it might accomplish?
Well, I think the readers have to be in two categories. One is, you know, the families themselves who are struggling with these questions of how to be caregivers and how to be providers. Mm-hmm. And that means, you know, young families, but also some middle-aged families, because many are in the sandwich generation who have to take care of young children while they're also taking care of elderly parents. But there has to be a grassroots movement. You know, we have to have, you know, liberal, conservative, the elderly, the young, really begin to make a demand for these changes, like affordable child care, like workplace flexibility, and like paid family and medical leave. Because you don't reach the upper level of the political strata if they don't hear from the grassroots, if they don't hear from their constituents. And the message from their constituency has to be, this is what we need. And the constituency, very broad, has to say, where do you stand? Where do you stand on child care? We've had this debate quietly, you know, behind closed doors or maybe in the playground about where am I going to find good child care? Who's going to pick up Johnny from preschool? How can I ask my boss for the afternoon off to attend a play? So these questions have been asked and discussed for many, many years, but they haven't been part of the public debate.
Right.
So I was talking to a gentleman yesterday when I was giving a book talk, and I asked, you know, why haven't liberals put this on their agenda? And they really haven't. And he said, because there's no political pressure. So there is neither punishment nor reward if you take up these issues. But I think that can change overnight. I think if politicians, if policymakers said, this is going to be our agenda, we're going to help working families to be stronger, to be good providers, to be able to take care of the people that women have traditionally taken care of, that these women are now in the workforce, we're going to put this on the agenda. And I think it'd be a winning issue all the way. But no politician has really made that the centerpiece. Women have fostered these issues, but it has never sort of gotten into the centerpiece where a politician understands, if I don't do this, I'm going to be in trouble. And we saw evidence of that just the day before yesterday.
Right.
When the Paycheck Fairness Act was blocked from even being taken up by a Republican coalition. Why did they do that? Because they thought they could get away with it.
But why? Why do they want to do that? That I was curious about.
Well, I think they appeal to a largely male-led business community.
Right.
And that community doesn't want to be bothered with having to deal with issues like equal pay. And also, I think a lot of people don't see it as a problem. They don't believe that there's a 77-cent wage gap, and because they don't see it right in front of them. Sometimes it's subtle. I mean, the law says now, and many businesses demand this in their contract, that you can't even ask the person in the next cubicle at work, how much money are you making? It's against the rules to do that. So if you don't know what the other person is earning, you don't get upset, of course, because you think you're fine.
Yeah.
So it's a question of education. It's a question of highlighting the problem that it really does exist. And their excuse was too many lawsuits. Well, the lawsuits may be there for a real reason, that there is unequal pay and people making the same job, that the woman earns less than the man at the same job, and there's a lot of evidence that backs that up. You know, the famous Lilly Ledbetter case, which President Obama signed the bill into law as the first bill he ever signed as president, and that was one step forward to narrow the wage gap. But this law, the Paycheck Fairness Act, was supposed to be the companion piece. And one reason that the wage gap has not been closed is because it's hard to sue and it's hard to get results.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the smallest wage gap is in Washington, D.C. And that is obviously because of the large number of government workers. And when you work for the government, your salary is public information.
Mm-hmm.
So just sunshine solves part of the problem.
Right, right. This is a quote from the book. Once we got out of the house, unlike our European sisters, we failed to make demands of our government for family paid leave laws, workplace flexibility, and quality child care. So why did we fail to do that?
Well, it's a question I ask myself still. Why we didn't move into that family work agenda is a very good question. There are a couple of answers. I think the women's movement in the United States was largely focused on the question of being able to control one's fertility and to find equity in other places. And it was not family-centered. The difference in Europe and in most other countries is some had a more socialist outlook, that we're not in it just for ourselves. We have to have a government that holds us together. You know, a lot of these countries also don't have the extremes, the earnings gap, where, you know, the 1% control most of the economy. So there's been more of a sense of community, and also a sense that we really have to take care of the children. And there are a couple of other things going on. Some of the European countries, like France and Germany, want to encourage women to be in the workplace because they have a declining birth rate. So there's an economic incentive to make it more amenable for women to work and more possible. I mean, you can't go to work if you don't have care for your child, whether that's in a child care center or whether it's with a family or a friend. So there was that powerful incentive to not lose population. Now, the United States has a pretty high birth rate, but that doesn't mean we don't have the problem. Probably the biggest problem we have, and it's partly related to the lack of family-friendly policies, is the level of child poverty. I was shocked to discover that our child poverty rate hovers between 20 and 22%. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's extremely high now with the recession. That's the highest child poverty rate of any industrialized country. Just for comparison, Sweden's poverty rate for children is 3%. Mm-hmm. And they're chagrined that it's 3%. And I wish we could be somewhat red-faced at our 20% poverty rate. So the poverty rate is affected very logically by how much income a family can bring in, how much a family earns, and that's often the mother and the father or the mother alone. For example, now we have a law on the books signed by Bill Clinton that is unpaid family and medical leave. And it's a good start, but it only works for a few lucky people. One, for people who are in a workplace that employs more than 50 people. But two, let's put yourself in the position of a new mother. As a new mom, suddenly your expenses shoot up. You know, you have to pay hospital bills, you have to pay for diapers, you have to pay for everything that comes with having a new child in the family. That's not the best time to give up your paycheck. Right. People simply can't afford to take unpaid family leave. Many people can't. Some can, and some corporations and businesses also provide paid family leave. But it's not the rule. So one of the consequences is that a new parent has to decide, do I quit my job to stay home with my child, or do I go right back to work? And that affects the income, especially if a mother says, I have to quit my job, I can't do this, I don't want to leave my newborn baby. And if that mother had the opportunity to work part-time, if there were flexibility, if she had the opportunity to stay home for 6 weeks or 6 months or a year, which is the case in England, she could not make that horrible choice between being with a newborn baby and being able to support that baby by continuing to have an income. Sure. So the consequence is that there's less money, there is less opportunity for a family to be above the poverty line. And what does it mean for this country to have so many children growing up poor? It means, and we know this from years of experience, that poor children have a less chance of growing up healthy. They have a reduced chance of being well-educated. And the long-term consequences are we're not going to have the skilled workforce that we need to fill the jobs that are often open today because nobody can fill them and will certainly be more of a problem in the years to come. So we are very short-term thinkers. Right. We think, what does it cost, you know, for this week's or this quarterly bottom line? We don't think about what does it cost for the year, for 5 years down the line.
Right. You mentioned other countries' policies, and I found it interesting to read in your book that Danish family leave policies, they can take time off before the birth of a child and after the birth of a child, and families where a father is not contributing to the child's care can get father money, which is paid by the government.
Yes.
That was really interesting to me.
Yes, they are very generous. But again, it's the philosophy or the policy that children should grow up under optimal circumstances, and that when possible, the mother should have the opportunity to take care of the child for the early months, and then should also have the opportunity through child care to go to work.
Sure, sure. You make the point often in the book that what's good for workers is good for employers. And this seems like an opportune time to talk about that a little bit. You know, I think that sometimes businesses are reluctant to give increased leave time for things like a new baby because they feel like it's going to cut into their profit margins or into their productivity. So can we talk a little bit about why what's good for the workers is good for the businesses?
Yes. And, you know, sometimes the immediate reaction is when you talk about workplace flexibility or paid 6 days, the knee-jerk reaction, oh, this is a job killer. I can't afford it. This is going to cost me money. But what they fail to recognize is if you, as an employer, recognize that your employees have family commitments, have family emergencies, and if you make allowances for that by saying, okay, you can go home early, your child is sick, and the school just called, and you have to pick him up, that employee is going to be grateful to you. That person is going to be that much more productive and loyal. And I was talking to a nurse the day before yesterday who was a nurse supervisor, and she said, you know, every time I allow somebody to do something for their families that is necessary, they come back and they work tenfold. Mm-hmm. And also what is missing is the cost of retraining people. More and more working families are going to look for jobs that are family friendly. That's even more important many times than the size of the paycheck. And in a competitive work environment, that's going to make a big difference. One of the people I write about in this book is James Wall of Deloitte, formerly known as Deloitte Touche, the accounting and financial firm. Well, James Wall, who's the human resources person and diversity person, found out that they had invested all this money in recruiting and training women. And they started out with an equal number of women and men. And about 10 years later, when it came time to appoint people to be on the boards of directors, there was this huge drop-off. Women were no longer there. And he realized this is a leaky pipeline that we've got to fix, because it costs them 2 to 5 times the cost of a salary to replace and retrain a new worker. So that is how we have to look at this question, that fortunately, there are employers now like Deloitte, and even in Vermont, IBM has been very good about paid maternity leave. So why do they do it? They do it not because they have any feminist leanings or because they just want to be good guys. They do it because it's good for business. Mm-hmm. It's a positive business policy. And that's why we've got to encourage these employers to speak up. Because the big opponent, the big gorilla that's not even in the closet, the gorilla is right out there, is the United States Chamber of Commerce. And they fight all of these policies. They're the strongest lobbying firm. They're either number one or number two in America. So the voices of individuals and the voices of far-sighted and productive businesses have to counter the loud voice of the Chamber of Commerce and, at times, the Business Roundtable.
Yeah. So let's talk about lobbyists and special interest groups and their voice and their donations to political causes. Can you talk about their impact on legislation affecting families? You already started to do that a little bit. And also just sort of ideas for how to counter the lobbyists and the special interest groups on a small sort of local level.
Well, by speaking up. Mm-hmm. And by really also applauding the good people. Good in the sense that they recognize that a family-friendly policy works. For example, I mentioned in the book my neighbor, Beth Saxon, my other neighbor, Jan Blittersdorf. And Jan Blittersdorf runs an wind energy company. And she was talking with another female CEO, and the other female CEO was complaining and said, every time a woman on my staff gets pregnant, she quits. And Jan said, none of my employees have quit. The difference is that Jan sat down with her pregnant employees, and when they gave birth, worked out a schedule, worked out a time she could take leave, worked out a reduced schedule for the first couple of years, and retained that valuable employee. Yeah. So your attitude makes all the difference.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got to encourage the employers who do well to counter the naysayers.
Yeah. Another aspect of all of this that you talk about in the book is workplace flexibility, which I found really interesting. My sister has a job where she telecommutes one day a week at least, and sometimes two, and it's just made all the difference in the world, you know, yeah. Because she's got a huge commute to work in a very busy traffic area. But anyway, you made the point that businesses could save $500 billion annually if American companies enabled more workers to telecommute as a point within workplace flexibility. And you also point out that making such changes requires a change in cultural assumptions, cultural perceptions. So I wonder if we can talk about that in a tiny bit.
Yes, well, with every controversial social issue, the question is always raised, how do you change attitudes? Does making a law change an attitude? You know, we see that very clearly now in terms of just the obesity issue. Mm-hmm. When the mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, just announced that sugary drinks should not be sold in New York over the quantity of 16 ounces, and all hell broke loose. But it certainly raised the question of obesity, and if it's upheld, it will have an impact. So I think you have to do both. You have to work on the cultural changes, but you have to give those changes a shove through the force of law. And, you know, we saw an interesting transition in this country, in fact, fascinating, and very quickly enacted, and that is our attitudes towards gay and lesbian couples or gay and lesbian individuals. You know, when I was governor, it was a very tough issue. And I believe I was the first governor to speak at a gay and lesbian pride parade in Burlington on Church Street. And you know, a couple of days later, somebody told me that my picture, which had been in the Free Press with gay and lesbian pride banner, had been pasted on a cash register in the Northeast Kingdom with a circle, red circle, and a slash through it. So I knew this was hot stuff, but I never expected that, you know, in 2012, the President of the United States would come out in support of same-sex marriage. So we've come a long way, and some of the laws, like our first civil union law, some of the courage of gay individuals coming out to their families, to their co-workers, has changed the culture, has changed the attitude. So I think it's a combination of both. And sometimes I grasp at straws, but one straw to grasp is that now in most restrooms, you have a baby-changing table. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist. Somebody suddenly discovered, yeah, babies need to be changed, and we don't make it easy to do it. I remember changing my babies on park benches or the back seat of a car because that's all you could do. And in some offices, which they should have by law now, have nursing rooms where you can sit quietly and not be disturbed to nurse your baby, your infant. So things are beginning. But, of course, these are tiny steps, I acknowledge. But what they lead to, in the best of all possible worlds, is a recognition that children have needs, families have needs, and society, instead of hiding that nursing baby, should be able to say, yes, that's part of what you should be enabled to do.
Right. And the interesting, another interesting point from your book, I'm trying to remember who it was you were interviewing at the time, but the point was made that in Europe, the American companies that have satellite offices in other countries have to follow the legislation of those countries. And so in a lot of cases, American employers are giving better benefits to people from other countries than they're giving to American employees at home. Which,
yes,
of course, is true because they have to follow the law. But when I read it, I was just outraged. I just was thinking, of course, that's happening. And it's so, it seems so wrong.
I found that striking, too, because, you know, these same employers are saying, we can't afford to do this. That's a job killer. Well, if it's a real job killer, why are they located in France and Germany and Sweden and Norway? If it was so bad for business, they sure wouldn't be there. So they're making money by playing by the same rules of the country they are in. So why can't they play by those same rules in the United States of America for their own American employees?
Yeah, wow. Why has one party so effectively co-opted the phrase family values while simultaneously doing so little to improve services for families? And why has the other party been so poor at fighting this?
Well, that's a very good question. And you're right on both counts. Well, family values really has become a very big suitcase. I mean, they put everything into it, from anti-gun control to anti-gay and lesbian, to anti-patriotic. Mm-hmm. And the word family has really become lost because it's only concentrated on the moment that contraception occurs. And, of course, there's a battle as to exactly when that moment is, so that it almost obliterates the idea of practicing birth control. But so it's become a catchphrase that does no longer have relevance to families. You know, what about family values affecting prenatal care? What about family values affecting nutrition? So, you know, these same family values groups have been part of the Paul Ryan House budget, which cuts Head Start, which cuts food stamps, which cuts forms of prenatal care. It's a total distortion of the phrase. But at the same time, Democrats have not fought it, as you say. What we must do is grab back that phrase and interpret it in its real meaning, values that support families, that strengthen families. Mm-hmm. And just like, you know, the flag was captured by the Republican Party, and every political person and many who were not in office had to sport a little flag. And I remember at one point during the campaign, Obama was questioned on why he didn't wear a flag lapel pin. And he said, well, I don't need to, I'm patriotic. But now, wherever you see him, he's got that lapel pin. So it shouldn't be owned by the Republican Party. And I think we have to bring back family values and reinterpret it. And I must say, progressives have not been at the forefront either. When they talk about progressive values, family values are often left out, or else they are a footnote to the agenda. So we got a lot of work to do on both sides. And the hardest work, but the most important work, is to try on some selective issues to bring both sides together. And I see a glimmer of light that we may be able to do that. We have to find a way to do it.
Yeah. Okay, great. You were the first woman governor in Vermont. You were the first Jewish woman to serve as governor in any state, I believe, and the first woman elected to that office 3 times. So I'm wondering, is there a single accomplishment from your time in office that you can point to as your proudest achievement?
Well, you know, it's very hard to do that, because I guess I would say it in general terms. You know, people talk a lot about power, that politicians are in the game because they want to exercise power. They're real egomaniacs, and you know, they want to stay in power as long as possible. Well, I guess what I get the most satisfaction from is that I was able to use my time as governor to empower others. And probably one of the long-term effects has been to the number of women I've been able to appoint, mm-hmm. Both in the judiciary and in the cabinet and the sub-cabinet. And these women, you know, this was their most of them, their first opportunity to have real responsibility and leadership, and they all were terrific, and many of them continue to contribute to the state of Vermont as we speak. But when it comes to specific legislation, we passed, and it seems antiquated now to talk about it, but the first kindergarten bill that required access to kindergarten, we started to a grant program for early childhood education. I was reminded by a group of sixth graders who were doing a video about me that I promoted the first unpaid family leave law in Vermont, and I remember speaking before the Chamber of Commerce on that, and one man was constantly shaking his head until I finally found a woman who was nodding and felt better. But then the Housing and Conservation Fund, that is a wonderful companion bill because it provided money for both affordable housing and conserving open spaces. And the Dr. Dinosaur program, mm-hmm. which provides health care for children and pregnant women. So there are some things that seem to have some staying power, but you never do enough. You always wish you could do more.
Mm-hmm. In reading the new feminist agenda, I was struck by what a great writer you are. And so I was reading about you online, and I realized that you were a journalist before you were governor and that you used to work for the Free Press.
Right.
And you went to the Columbia School of Journalism.
Correct.
So that was, I never knew that about you.
So, yes, that was my first foray into this world, and I hadn't thought of running for office, until the women's movement appeared on the scene, and that was a wake-up call.
How many children did you have when you first ran for office?
Four.
You had four already when you
first
ran for office.
Yes, I had four when I ran for the legislature. My youngest was 2.5, and it was thanks to a very good daycare center that I was able to do it, and to a woman, Shirley LaBelle, who came in when my kids were coming home from school. And of course, being in the legislature is a part-time job, mm-hmm. so it was much more manageable to combine both. And when I ran for governor, three of my children were in college and one was in high school, so that made it somewhat easier, though of course it was a 24/7 job.
Yeah. I was a little bit surprised and a little bit impressed in reading your book when you commented that you do not see Sarah Palin as exploiting her family when she has them front and center next to her on stage, that in fact you feel that probably serves the family well in this country, that a woman in her position is bringing her family with her. And so I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about that.
Yes. I mean, she's the first politician I'm aware of who did bring her family out in the open and on stage. And of course, there's some risk in that. Some people thought she was exploiting her Down syndrome baby at the time. And then when her daughter became pregnant, and it, the family saga is now well known. But what I took away from it was that she's showing that you can be a good mother and be engaged in politics. Of course, I don't agree with her politics, but I do have to give her credit for having made that statement very visibly. You know, when I first ran for the legislature, there was a debate amongst my informal advisors whether to have a photograph in the campaign brochure with my husband, of course, and my four children. And because the fear was people would instantly ask, who's taking care of the kids?
Yeah.
And that was a question and still is a question which often is not asked but is thought. And as I say in the book, the family dog, of course, is terribly popular. So she was easy to include. I don't think you have to do that anymore.
No.
Though it's still there a little bit, but not for most legislative races, and less so for Congress, too. But a woman running for president you know, the family issues are very much in the forefront, and more so for governor, any executive office where you really are the CEO, there are lots of questions. Who is she? Can she do this? What about her husband? And so the questions are not always asked out loud, but they're certainly in the background.
Mm-hmm. What is your response to arguments like, why should I pay for their health care? Why should I pay for someone else's kids' education or leave? When you're speaking with Americans who don't want to see their taxes raised to cover better benefits for families.
Yes, I mean, it is a question. And again, I don't think we should have this generational war, you know, young people against old people. What has really happened since Social Security and Medicare became universally available for people over 65 is that the elderly have vastly improved their economic condition. The elderly used to be the really low-income class, no longer. Of course, that doesn't include everybody, but as a group, these two widely available programs have changed the economic condition of everybody. And my point would be, if we improve the condition of children and families, all of us would benefit. You know, one person I interviewed put it best when she said, who's going to pay your Social Security? You know, if we don't have a good workforce, if we don't enable young parents to work, the money won't go into the federal budget to pay for your Social Security. So there's a shared interest. Yeah. And yes, sometimes people don't get that. And you have to educate them that it's in your interest to have your next door neighbor's children grow up in good conditions and to enable your next door neighbor to be able to earn income. Yeah. Because if they end up you know, either dire poverty or using government services more than the average person, you're going to pay for that. So it's a shared interest. And there is a group that I included in the book that actually is a group of elderly people who want to work for children. And we need more intergenerational thinking. And a lot of these policies obviously affect the elderly too. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, older people, would like to go back to work or may have to go back to work, but they don't want to work full time. So workplace flexibility, distance work situations, telecommuting, those would help every sector mm-hmm. of the population. So my hope is that we can join forces right. with AARP and work and family organizations, because each can benefit from the other's participation.
Sure. You quote Anita Hill in the book. It was a really interesting quote. She said that most women want to distance themselves from anger. I think actually that's your wording. And mm-hmm. she said they don't want to be labeled feminazis. So how does that attitude hurt or help the cause of feminism, in your opinion, women not wanting to be seen as angry?
Well, you have to deal with anger carefully. And she's right, because the caricature of the feminist is this angry, you know, waving a bra in the air woman, which never actually happened. But and it's, of course, especially dangerous for black women to show anger, just like it is dangerous for a black man to show anger. But the downside of being careful is that nobody even knows you're angry. If right. you're not angry, nothing's going to change. So, you know, I have these three boxes that I use as a virtual PowerPoint to show what is it that makes you get up and say, I got to do something about this. You know, get out of your easy chair, out of your comfort zone, and into the discomfort zone. And the three boxes that I have is, first one contains anger, because you've got to be mad about something to want to do something. The second box contains imagination, because you have to be able to imagine things being different. And the third is optimism, that you think it's worth it. Something actually is going to happen if I stick my neck out. So Anger is the catalyst, very often, for change.
The book's title, The New Feminist Agenda. Who titled the book?
Well, actually, my publisher, and we had a serious debate about whether to use the word feminist in the title. And I was apprehensive about that, because I was afraid it would turn a lot of people off, because... For the same reasons as we just talked about anger. But since then, I've been getting interesting reactions. No doubt, some people won't pick up the book because of the word feminist. But then I gave a talk just the other evening in Washington, and it's happened more than once. Some young women applauded the idea that feminist was in the title. And I think there's some new bubbling up of interest in the word feminism and in the whole concept as a result of things like Rush Limbaugh attacking Sandra Fluke, or George Washington law student who testified in favor of access to contraception, and he called her a slut. And in fact, somebody sent me a slut button, which some women are wearing. I haven't had quite the guts yet to wear it, especially for people who wouldn't know what this was all about. But I think it's okay now. Bottom line is, no matter what you call yourself, if you're repelled by the word or if you're attracted by the word, all women have to get on the same page at this point if we're going to create change and hold on to what we have. I mean, the battle is really on two fronts right now, with the erosion of Roe v. Wade, state by state, and possibly at the federal and even at the Supreme Court level, with the concept of birth control being challenged. We've got to mobilize to hold on to the rights that were won 47 years ago. 47 years ago, the Supreme Court decided on Griswold versus Connecticut that contraception was legal. And here we are 47 years later trying to defend it. I mean, it's astounding to me. So we have to do that, but we also have to move forward. We can't deplete all our energy on just holding on. We have to energize ourselves to move forward on these family work issues.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Rush Limbaugh incident with Sandra Fluke, and it just reminds me of the opening of this book where you said you are angry, and it seems that his comments made a lot of people angry,
right,
which is probably not a bad thing,
right,
for people to get angry. You write about a declining trust in the government. I'm just wondering if you think this translates more readily into action or apathy on the part of Americans.
Very good question. Probably a little of each. You know, the government is making decisions at the state, local, national level, whether we like it or not, whether we're silent or whether we speak out. And, you know, just take, for example, the United States Supreme Court. The new members of the court, like Roberts and Alito, when they were being confirmed, they said, we don't want an activist court. We're conservatives. We're traditionalists. Well, it turns out this is the most activist court we've had in a very long time. But they are overturning laws to suit their activist conservative, often Tea Party, agenda. So the government is making decisions in the Congress, in your local legislature. So the question for the voter is, do I just sit back and let it happen, or do I raise my voice? It isn't as if the government doesn't do anything. The government does things, but you may not agree with what the government is doing. So some people feel that one voice, a lot of people feel that one voice can't make a difference. They feel that the system is rigged to begin with, or that money has such an overpowering influence that the individual citizen can't be heard. And I can very well understand that. With the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allows corporations and individuals to raise unlimited amounts of money to influence the outcome of an election. I mean, the recent recall vote in Wisconsin, the anti-recall folks raised 7 times the amount of money as the pro-recall people. 7 times. Now, that's bound to have an impact. But having said all that, I still think individuals can make a difference. And if we remain silent, they fill the vacuum. So we have to not let that vacuum be filled exclusively by the other side. We have to try to really shout and make ourselves heard and oppose what we feel is wrong and support what we feel is right. And that's the heart of democracy. If we give up on that, we really give up on the democratic process.
Okay. Well, Governor Madeleine Cunin, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, Shayla. Thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Madeleine M. Cunin. Madeleine Cunin's website is madeleinecunin.org. Has a lot more information about her work there. And because the content of the day's show was political, I feel the need to remind you that the views, opinions, and conclusions expressed on Write the Book are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of WBTV LP. Today's Write the Book prompt is to write about a prejudice that you know yourself to have. I think we all probably have prejudices, if we're going to be honest with ourselves. So write a scene, write an essay, write just a paragraph, write a poem about a prejudice that you know yourself to have. Write about how you feel about that, and write about how other people who may or may not recognize it would feel if they knew. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know, please, that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. You can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. We will soon be broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. When that happens, we will be telling you all about it. This show is on every Monday at 3 at this time. It goes for 2 hours from 3 to 5. The second hour features reruns, possibly other new content as yet to be designed, and I am very curious to hear what you might have for suggestions for the second hour of the show. The first hour is interviews with authors, poets, agents, editors. Tune in or stream the show live tune in once we're at 99.3 FM, which we're not yet, or stream the show live at 99.3wbtv.org. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, which I can then announce in the weekly Bookworms calendar, do send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. And that's it for today. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.